Today on Wisconsin Politics Weekly, Wisconsin leaders react to the shooting in Minneapolis, a presidential endorsement shakes up the governor's race, and top leaders in Wisconsin state government hint that they're open to some kind of deal on lowering property taxes. Maybe. I'm WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. Joining me today to talk about these issues are PBS Wisconsin political reporter Zach Schultz, WPR Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk, and WPR political reporter Rich Kramer. Hey, everyone.
Hey, Sean.
So let's start the conversation with the news that has just been front and center everywhere this week in Wisconsin and nationally, the shooting of Alex Preddy in Minneapolis. We've heard everyone from the president to protesters react to this. Anya, I want to hear what our local leaders and candidates are saying in Wisconsin. What have we heard them say about what happened in Minneapolis and where we go from here?
Yeah, the one sort of unifying word that's been used is tragedy. Both sides are describing the event as tragic, but Republicans have really, by and large, been placing the blame at the feet of Democratic leaders in Minnesota and Minneapolis. And so Ron Johnson, for example, he appeared on Wisconsin Today earlier this week, and he really kept saying that the issues were created by Democratic presidents, immigration issues were created by them, exacerbated by Democratic leaders. By contrast, Tammy Baldwin, our other U.S. senator, took to the floor of the Senate to read comments about Alex Preddy's life. He was, of course, a Wisconsin native and really condemned this action. And then on the gubernatorial trail, all seven Democratic candidates have in some way denounced ICE. Several of them have called for the disbanding of the agency. Then at the other end of that, you have Tom Tiffany, who is at this point, as of just a couple days ago, the only Republican left in the race for governor. And he spoke at an event here in Madison on Monday. And I asked him, have you seen the video of this event? And he was caught kind of off guard and sort of hedged a little bit. Another reporter followed up, well, did you watch it or no? And he said, no, I did not.
So what are we to make of that? I mean, that's the response that got everybody's attention was kind of his lack of a response.
You know, I think that he has to really kind of thread this needle, right? He's currently a sitting U.S. congressperson in a conservative district up north, but he is running for governor in a purple state. And so that means that he has to appeal to a kind of wider audience. And so I think we saw him try to thread the needle and maybe not quite know how to do that in that moment.
Rich, we also heard from the president in reaction to this shooting in no uncertain terms that you can't bring guns to protests, he said. You heard similar comments from members of his administration. You talked to a number of Second Amendment advocates here in Wisconsin, gun rights advocates in a state where guns are a big deal. What were they telling you?
I'd say the overall theme that I heard from them is that those comments that a person can't bring a firearm to a protest are just not true, that the Constitution guarantees a person's right to bear arms. That's the Second Amendment. And that they just shouldn't be saying that. But that's essentially where the unity ended. There were some different interpretations that I heard about maybe what the administration was trying to say, that maybe that they were focusing on safety and taking into account that each state has its own laws with regard to guns, so they were kind of doing a blanket statement. Others were just outright opposed to what they were saying and said it's just not tethered to law or the Constitution or anything like that. I also talked with a gentleman named Dan Marcon. He owns a gun range near Eau Claire. He's been an instructor for concealed carry classes for 10 years. And he gave me a scenario where he lives in a neighborhood, let's say, and he's walking down the street, there's a protest. He said he carries his pistol all the time, he's licensed, and he said, I'm not supposed to have it if there's a protest. He used some colorful language to describe that idea to me.
So there's a lot of candor there in terms of their critiques of the president that you don't normally hear. Have you heard that same kind of commentary from anybody who's elected in Wisconsin? You know, the Republican Party has really aligned itself with the gun rights over the years and the NRA. Have you heard anybody who's elected saying similar things here?
I certainly haven't. And maybe the others on the panel had different experiences.
Well, we've heard radio silence from social media from all the Republicans. So that's a big statement all by itself. If they're not commenting, and, you know, going back to what you're talking about, Tom Tiffany, threading that needle, we've seen that from Republicans in Washington for a decade now with Donald Trump, where anything that they don't want to have to respond to, they haven't seen. You can take him at his word or not at his word, whether he actually did not see or did see the video, but he certainly is aware of the protest because Tom Tiffany's been tweeting and commenting about it repeatedly. As for elected officials, I interviewed Maria Lazar, who is a Supreme Court candidate. She is an appellate court judge. And I asked her about Kash Patel, the FBI director, who made the first set of statements on air about you can't bring a loaded firearm to a protest. And she kind of hedged a little bit, saying, well, I'm not really an expert in Minnesota law, but since they have concealed carry, she said, I kind of doubt that under the Second Amendment, which surprised me because to me it seems pretty clear. We don't need to go beyond our own eyes when it comes to all the video we've seen of protests over the years. Think back to COVID. Think back to January 6, 2021 at the U.S. Capitol. I mean, there have been guns at protests for years and years, and people have been asserting and claiming this right. And this is the first time that anyone at that, especially from the Republicans, have said that you don't have that right. And if that's the case, then it really is incongruous with what their supporters have been acting on for a long, long time.
So one thing we did hear Congressman Tiffany and other Republicans talk about this week was President Trump's endorsements in Wisconsin's governor's race. And we say this, you know, every election cycle, like there's nothing more powerful in today's Republican politics than an endorsement from President Donald Trump. I think there'd been kind of an open question about whether he would jump in this time. He did. He endorsed Tom Tiffany. Talk about a quick reaction to what happened, Zach. I mean, what unfolded after that?
Well, his only primary candidate opponent, Josh Shulman, Washington County exec, dropped out immediately, pretty much. And what's interesting is I interviewed both Tiffany and Shulman back in December, and I asked them about what impact Donald Trump would have on their primary. And Shulman at that time said, well, of course I would love his endorsement, but otherwise I hope he doesn't endorse. His goal was to take this primary as far as he could to show that he was a legitimate challenger in the eyes of Republican voters against Tom Tiffany, who has more money, more name recognition, closer relationship with President Trump, having, you know, been a member of Congress and supported him at that level with his votes for a long, long time. So clearly, Shulman knew that an early Trump endorsement was pretty much going to end his campaign, and he made that clear when he dropped out the next day.
So, Rich, I know one thing you were kind of keeping an eye on was whether it would be another Republican jump into the race. You know, somebody like Tim Michaels, who we know Donald Trump likes and who can self-fund, you know, whether they would jump in. This kind of says, no, that's not going to happen, right?
Yeah, it certainly seems like we're down to one for the Republican primary, essentially, and that gives Republicans an advantage in some ways. They don't have to pay a lot of money in a messy primary. They don't have to carry that baggage into a general election. But at the same time, Democrats now have their target. They kind of were acting like that Tiffany was the target anyway, but now that's it. So I guess anything could happen, but at this point, it seems like we've got our Republican candidate for the gubernatorial campaign.
And now we get to have that debate we have every election cycle too. Do you want to have a big primary or don't you? And I think this time Republicans are going to be the ones saying, no, we're glad we don't have a primary to deal with, because those have kind of bitten them in recent years. You just look back at 2022 and the primary between Tim Michaels and Rebecca Clayfish was very bruising. Tim Michaels did not win that general election. You have a big primary among Democrats, about seven candidates, give or take. I imagine, though, they are saying, hey, that's actually good for us. We're going to dominate this news cycle. But what are you hearing from them in terms of how they view the race now? Has it changed anything, really?
Well, there's nobody in the Democratic field who has that level of name recognition as Tom Tiffany. There's not, for example, another congressperson or somebody with that level. And so a lot of Democratic candidates are still just trying to register outside of whatever their current lane is, whether it's that they're currently a state representative, they need to register more broadly across the state, or they are a former lieutenant governor who's trying to kind of build back up his profile, or a current lieutenant governor is trying to build her profile. So there's nobody who really kind of has that momentum behind them, such as it is. And so I think we're going to see just a very different type of primary race among Democrats, because it's not just about being able to sell yourself to voters. It's also about being able to stand out in what is basically, you know, a field that has pretty shared values. There's people further to the left and further to the center, but they really are Wisconsin Democrats, and there's a lot of shared values there. So how do you kind of emerge and make enough of a splash to carry you through to November?
And it'll be interesting to see if this has similarities to the Senate, Democratic Senate primary for Senate, when Mandela Barnes came out ahead, because his opponents at that time in the Democratic lane all dropped out essentially before the primary, saying that our only option at that point was to go negative. And so I think what'll be interesting to watch among these Democrats is which ones are holding themselves above the fray and focusing exclusively on Tom Tiffany, as someone like Mandela Barnes has from the start, or someone who's maybe, like you said, trying to gain a little more name recognition outside of their lane. Do they start taking shots at their own field, or do they focus all of their fire collectively at Tom Tiffany? And that will determine whether a primary is helpful or unhelpful. If they come out of it bruised because it turned negative because someone was trying to win with 23% of the vote in the Democratic primary, then it will leave a bruised candidate on the other side. But if they all focus on Tom Tiffany and may the best candidate win, and some of them graciously drop out, as we saw before, then yes, they could have a more cohesive Democratic Party with a stronger, more battle-tested candidate coming out in August.
So, you know, I do think that we'll see the field narrow, but I wonder if some of them would look at that example from the Senate race and say, yeah, they took one for the team and look where it got them. You know, imagine if you're Sarah Godlewski thinking, hey, I could have been senator if it was me on that ballot. You know, you would assume that everyone who runs for office that level thinks they can win the general election. I mean, that could be a factor in whether or not they decide to sort of bow out this time. And you could have potentially a race going up to August, especially in this cycle. You know, we've got a Democratic cycle potentially. I think every Democrat feels like they want to be the one standing when that's over. Are they going to have money? Is a question after every primary. Are they going to have enough money to deal with Tom Tiffany, who doesn't have to worry about, you know, running ads to build up his conservative base?
Yeah, right now the Democratic sort of donor field is divided among seven people. And we've seen in past election cycles where people run out of money leading up to the primary election. I think even Tony Evers started to run out of money before successfully winning his first gubernatorial campaign. And so to the extent that they can, that if people start moving out, that will also coalesce the donor base both inside the state and outside. Because also, I mean, national attention is on this governor's race.
And we do have, while this race is going, and it does feel like all of our attention is on November at this point in some ways, but we have a state legislature that is still meeting here in Wisconsin. They could still potentially get things done. You know, the assemblies, whenever they're meeting, they got like 100 bills on the calendar and they rip through them, as you all know. There are some big outstanding issues there that I guess are question marks on whether they could cut one more bipartisan deal with the Democratic governor. One thing I wanted to ask you about was property taxes. Is that one where there could be some kind of deal this session? Because we're hearing both Tony Evers and Republican leaders, at least Speaker Robin Voss, say, hey, you know, we're open to something on property taxes. Who here thinks they could get it done?
I mean, it sounds like there have been talks in private caucus, and you've even heard sort of lower-level Republicans alluding to this, you know, maybe speaking a little bit out of turn in so doing. And so that gives us a little bit of a sense that there are conversations happening between at least Robin Voss and Tony Evers. I'm not sure where things kind of stand on the Senate side of things. But it's also interesting to hear Republicans talking about using the state surplus for this, because what they have always said is that the surplus is only for tax returns, essentially. And so if you say, okay, property tax relief is like kind of in that field of things that Republicans would approve of using that money for, and Tony Evers can use that fund because he's been saying, let's spend down the surplus on all these other priorities that I have. Maybe that is a place that they say, okay, we have $2.5 billion or whatever to play with. He wants 1.3. What is the horse trading that's going to kind of get them both there?
I don't know. Zach, what do you think? Is this something that can happen this year?
Well, we've seen this game before. As you said, there's been a surplus pretty much Governor Evers' entire time because they can't agree. Evers wants spending on education. Republicans want tax cuts. This time it almost feels like it's a marriage of the two concepts, because Evers is framing this and Republicans are framing it in relief of Evers' so-called 400-year property tax veto, in which he allows school districts to spend extra per pupil, and conveniently both sides declined to fund that in the last budget. That was a bipartisan solution to not fund that additional thing, which raised property taxes at the local level because districts need that money, and they took it, which saw the property tax bills go up. Everyone saw the sticker shock in December, and they're feeling it. So this is a solution there. What's caused this problem not to be solved in the past is that there's always another election. And someone always has the mindset that if I allow you to get a win, that hurts me. There's a zero-sum mentality in politics when it comes to elections. And there's always been a fear that, well, if we give you this, then you'll come out looking better than we will in the end process. Now, the difference here is Evers is not running for re-election. So he's not the one that would stand to be able to run on this in the fall. So that gives you an idea why Republicans might consider this. If they can pass it, claim they helped solve the property tax issue. But then that leaves open the question, is there someone in the Senate, or is there someone that would want to spike this bill? Because they don't want anyone else to get credit for it. Or conversely, do they want to spike this bill because they want that surplus there, thinking that maybe Tom Tiffany's the winner and Republicans control legislature next year and they can come into office and have all this money to do in the way, spend in the way they want to spend rather than having to compromise. And those are always the questions to look at when it comes to motivations. It's not just about what makes sense now, it's what makes sense in the fall.
Rich, you know, this is a problem for both of them, arguably. I mean, you could argue that the 400-year veto caused the property tax increase. You could argue that the underfunding of schools by Republicans caused it. Does that make them want to come to the table here before Tony Evers leaves office?
Well, I don't know if the blame game makes them want to come back to the table or come to the table together. We've seen those arguments you just laid out all over the place. Republicans, of course, saying, Evers, you caused this, shame on you. And then Democrats are saying that schools have been underfunded. You know, this is a decade-long problem at the hands of the Republicans. But I keep thinking about some of the bipartisan examples we've seen. There was the state budget where Republicans in the Senate were not all on board with the proposal, and they used Democratic votes to get around some of those Republican members. There's all kinds of examples. Even the press conference with Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Greta Neubauer regarding funding for Wisconsin Eye, the Public Affairs Network down in Madison. So just there's been a few examples of surprises to me, having remembered the earlier years of, say, the Walker administration, and the legislature had total control. Republicans had control of the legislature, and they just weren't really open to compromise much at all back then.
Yeah. I guess we will find out very soon whether compromise is still in the air with, now a lame duck governor and these particular legislators, or whether it is on to November for everybody at this point, and that one just gets kicked to 2027. That'll do it for today. Thanks for joining us. Make sure to follow the show at WPR.org, PBSWisconsin.org, on YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.